This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It's a great pleasure to be speaking with William P. Stiple, Bill Stiple. His book, Generals in Bronze, are interviews by the illustrator for Harper's and Scribner's Back and Forth of James Kelly in the latter part of the 19th century into the early 20th century. Generals who were on the battlefield and also had political ambitions afterwards. And Kelly would meet them generally at the Fifth Avenue Hotel. There were other places stopping in New York as they passed through. As America grew in wealth, it also grew in storytelling of what happened when the country's the Second Revolution, the Civil War. We go now to one man who was present at the Gettysburg battlefield, and that's where Bill and I first met, so we're keen on mentioning some of the detail of that day, those 3 days. Not too much, because we'll get lost. Joshua T. Chamberlain. Joshua Chamberlain, later president of Bowdoin College, later governor of Maine, hero to everyone, dying in 1914. I believe he's listed as the last man wounded in the Civil War to die of his wounds, the wounding at Petersburg. Joshua Chamberlain is a scholar. He's an intellectual. He's a surprising personality given that day in Gettysburg. The question that always comes to mind is, how did they hold the line at Little Round Top? It wasn't until I stood on Little Round Top that I understood the climb that Hood's men had coming up, detail that you don't get from an overhead map. However, there is a controversy that day, and I want to explore it only momentarily because Kelly touches upon it several times. These men who were generals, living and dead afterwards, would argue forever. The ghosts would argue with the living. The living would argue with each other about who said what. There are many visions of those days. There's a man named Gouverneur Warren, who was a commander, a general, on the day of Gettysburg. Warren is the one who told Chamberlain, get up there. Don't pay attention to your orders to go there. You have to get up there because that's the left flank of the whole Union Army. And Warren becomes extremely important to Chamberlain. But there's an incident at the Battle of Five Forks. This is as Lee flees Petersburg, in which General George Meade relieves Warren afterwards. And it becomes important to Sheridan to denounce Warren as shy, I believe. That would have been the 19th century word. Your opinion of this controversy, which dances through these pages, and the prosecution continued until the 1880s, and Chamberlain would testify for Warren, and others would testify for Sheridan, and Sheridan wouldn't back out. It's like a subplot for your book, Bill. Do you have an opinion of what happened?
Well, Kelly was present at the Warren Court of Inquiry there in New York City. It took place after the war. Warren was trying to, let's more or less clear his name for being relieved of command at the Battle of Five Forks. And it was a military hearing, and there were many testimonies pro and anti-Warren. Warren did get more sympathy, I believe, after the war, and he was exonerated for, let's say, being shy at the Battle of Five Forks, slow. But Sheridan was the one that relieved Warren, and it became a stain on Warren's long military career, which was eventually And Chamberlain was also there at Five Forks, and he witnessed the battle. He's in the thick of it. And his testimony, I believe, did help Warren be exonerated for slowness.
Let's look at Chamberlain's life from the point of view of Kelly sketching him, because there's a lot of attention to the wounding of Chamberlain at Petersburg, as I recall. Yes. When Chamberlain was ordered with his unit, it was at that point he was commanding a brigade, more than one regiment, and he was wounded carrying the colors, his command colors, walking forward into a line of Confederate fire. Now, it always struck me that those orders were bloody-minded, Bill. How did it strike you? There was no cover. They were walking straight into massed guns.
Yeah, that That was typical of the Civil War, frontal assault, an infantry assault, lines of men approaching other lines of men. Sometimes the other men would be entrenched. And when Chamberlain's brigade was ordered to carry those trenches, Chamberlain led the way, carrying the colors. Was shot through the lower body, the bullet entering one hip, exiting the other, hitting vital organs. And Chamberlain tells Kelly that he had to use his sword as a tripod to keep himself standing. And seeing himself bleed, and Chamberlain thought, what he tells Kelly, he goes, "That's more than a man can bleed. It's Bucky, Phil Bucketsville, we're leaving him." But he was saved, and the wound eventually recovered to take further command during the war, but he suffered from it for the rest of his life, and, you know, they say it was the cause of death, you know, close to 50 years later.
Yes, there were many operations that had to happen because of the wounding of his internal organs. Staying with Chamberlain, however, the interview is a fascination because Chamberlain has opinions. For example, he reminds all of us it's Roosevelt, not Roosevelt. I like that detail. He has an opinion also of Grant and an opinion of the politics of the moment. It's a very in-depth interview with him. I've seen nothing like it comparable. Chamberlain was generous towards him. I mean, generous towards Kelly. And Kelly, at this point, he's been doing these sketches for some years. He's grown into a charmer, Bill. That's how I read these texts. Now, you've read more than I have. Was that something that's throughout the body of it?
Yes. Kelly was sincere in his admiration and his art, his dedication to his craft. And these generals respected that. And I think these generals actually enjoyed going to Kelly's studio, which was on 57th Street in Manhattan. And he had a big comfy chair there, and these generals would sit. And in some ways, it was like therapy. They got to unload on Kelly and tell Kelly some of those stories that they would not put in their memoirs. Chamberlain does have some criticisms of the government during the war, and he comments to Kelly that one day he should write the dark history of the war. It would astonish people. And Kelly says, "General Chamberlain, you should do it. You must do it." But he didn't. Chamberlain did not write that kind of book back then. You didn't write Tell All. If you had a criticism of Lincoln, you did not put that in your memoirs. Okay? He's the martyred president. You would not write it in your memoirs. They would perhaps talk about it, but they would not write about it.
Abner Doubleday, back to the Gettysburg battlefield, Bill. This is tense. Let's not go into too much detail, but it's tempting. Okay. Reynolds is commander of the First Corps. Buford the day before, the 30th of June into the morning of the 1st. Buford is commanding a cavalry division, and he has parts of it with him at Gettysburg, which is the spokes of a wheel. All the roads lead into Gettysburg. Buford has a sense that the Confederate Army is coming up that road from Chambersburg and sends a runner to Reynolds to get the lead of the Army of the Potomac to get up here by the morning, or we're going to lose the whole advantage we have. Reynolds is the hero of everyone, commanding the First Corps. But it's Reynolds who gets so close to the battlefield in the wood to the left of flank of what becomes the battlefield that he shot in the neck, is the detail Chamberlain, Abner Doubleday reports, in the deck, and is dead immediately on the ground. Doubleday, commanding a subordinate, commanding a division in the First Corps, is now senior on the field, if I remember. But this was controversial. How so, Bill? And how did they resolve it years later? Were they still talking about it?
They talked about it till the end of their lives. And Doubleday was thrust into that position. He did not seek command of the First Corps, but suddenly you find yourself in command of a corps where you might not even know where the brigades are located on a battlefield. And, Doubleday, I believe, did his best. His First Corps was forced to retreat. And it was more of an orderly retreat compared to the 11th Corps, which was north of the town of Gettysburg, that corps commanded by General Howard. They were pushed back through the town, we'll call it Helter Skelter, only to rally on Cemetery Hill, which General Howard had the foresight to leave some troops there as a fallback position. And it worked.
Yes, and then Hancock comes up and challenges Doubleday's seniority and takes over, and that remains the controversy. I understand it sounds petty, but it's a wonderful detail of what happens with your army being cut up all around you. You have no sense of where Lee is, or that there's a whole Confederate corps coming from the north that has broken the 11th, and they're in pell-mell through the town. And the cemetery above, it sounds like a place you don't want to make a last stand, but there it was. And it was Doubleday's genius to be keen on it. Did Chamberlain have an opinion? I don't remember him commenting on this.
Well, he was in the 5th Corps at the time, commanding only of a regiment, the 20th Maine Infantry, and they had yet arrived at the Battle of Gettysburg. They arrived.
So he didn't evidence an opinion. He didn't wait.
He didn't. But, you know, a lot of the generals, they had to take sides when a controversy like, who chose the battlefield at Gettysburg? Did Meade intend on retreating and so on? Those points are still argued to this day. What if Lee had ordered the assault on Cemetery Hill and his subordinate generals followed through, like General Ewell and Early? Had they taken Cemetery Hill on the 1st? Would Stonewall Jackson, if he was alive, would he have taken Cemetery Hill? I don't do what ifs, but that's the part of the interest in Gettysburg today. People still argue what happened and what could have happened.
Yes, I recommend when you find Bill at the Gettysburg Museum to walk up to him and say, "All right, what's your defense of Hancock taking possession of First Corps that first day, which saves the battle?" I'm speaking to Bill Stiple. The book is Generals in Bronze, Interviewing the Commanders of the Civil War. When we come back, the extremely colorful Dan Sickles. Before and after the war. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.